Hello and welcome to She's the Doctor, the podcast where we hear from women in medicine about their life and career so far. We'll discuss their interests and achievements, but also explore challenges and failures. I'm your host, Dr. Radhika Thakra, an oversharing houseplant-loving pediatric trainee in London. Every week, I'll be interviewing women from a range of backgrounds in a variety of medical specialties and at different points in their career, each with their own story to tell. I'll be honest, I felt ever so slightly starstruck interviewing Dr. Tessa Davis in today's episode. Tessa has a lot of titles. She is a pediatric emergency medicine consultant in London, co-founder of Don't Forget the Bubbles, the educational website for all things pediatrics, and a writer. She uses Twitter to share tips to over 100,000 followers on how to improve your use of technology, mastering your presentation skills, and optimizing the education you deliver. In this episode, we delve into these in more detail. Don't forget the bubbles, Tessa's Twitter, the emergency medicine masters she recently set up, and we also chat about life as a consultant and how she manages this all with three children and two dogs. It's a really interesting episode, and I hope you enjoy it. Welcome to She's the Doctor, Tessa. Thank you so much for joining us today in this ridiculous heat wave.
Thank you for having me. It is lovely to have some sunny weather.
It is. I think it's too hot though. Like, I'm always craving sun, and now it's like, okay, can we have some cold temperatures now?
Well, I'm actually Australian as well, so it reminds me to hot summers in Sydney.
Nice. I saw on Twitter actually that you recently won an award at the RCPCH conference, so congratulations for that.
Thank you.
What exactly was it for? What in particular? I know you do so much, but what in particular was it for?
Well, you know, it was really nice. It was really nice to get an award and to be honoured by the college, which is really, like, it's nice. It was for contribution to paediatrics and the work with Don't Forget the Bubbles, and some work I've done with Eurostance, which is another organisation I was involved with, which teaches young people at risk of serious youth violence how to do basic life support and hemorrhage control. So it was for a combination of these, but you know, it was really nice. And also, because I won the award, I got to bring someone along to the conference, and so I got to take my mum with me.
Oh my goodness.
Which was so nice, and she was delighted. It was a very proud parental moment for her, and it was nice that I was able to share it with her.
That is so nice, and I love that, like, even so far into your career, you can still share these nice moments with your parents, because for me, whenever anything exciting happens, my parents are the first people I tell.
Yeah.
And I love that you're still doing that at a consultant level.
Yeah, of course.
Is your mum medical?
She's not medical. She is actually a professor, so she's probably been to more conferences than I have. But she's a psychology professor, so not medical.
Oh, well, that's so nice that she got to share that experience with you. I was wondering if you wouldn't mind just introducing yourself to the listeners, if that's okay.
Sure. I'm Tessa Davis. I'm a paediatric emergency medicine consultant at the Royal London Hospital, and I'm a senior lecturer at Queen Mary University of London, and I am co-founder of Don't Forget the Bubbles.
So you're a paediatric emergency medicine consultant. How much of your time do you spend doing that in relation to all the other things that you do?
So I do 0.6 of my job is at the Royal London in paediatric emergency.
Okay. And what do you do for the rest of the time? All the other things?
So I do 0.4 is at Queen Mary, where I run a master's in paediatric emergency medicine that I set up, and that I'm the program director for, and we started last year. And then I do an extra 0.1 as deputy director of medical education at the Royal London, which is just a job that I've started recently.
So you're 1.1 working overtime already on a contract that you probably work more than the contracted hours.
But I enjoy all the balance is really good for me, the split between these roles. So yeah.
It's and that is something I also want to ask you about later, how you balance all of your time. You just mentioned Don't Forget the Bubbles. So do you mind telling us a little bit more about that? Because as a pediatric trainee, I have used it so many times, and it feels a real honor to be speaking to you, the person that founded it. So would you mind just telling the listeners who may never have heard of it, what exactly Don't Forget the Bubbles is?
So actually, it started 10 years ago, and it was just a blog. At the time, I realized there was no pediatric blog. There was a lot of emergency medicine websites. And so I just tweeted out, I was on Twitter then, I just tweeted, does anyone fancy starting a peds blog? And there was kind of silence and tumbleweed for several days. And then three people stepped forward and I'd never met them before, but that was who we had. So we went for it. And so we started just as an educational website. And, you know, not we worked very hard to make sure there was content on there before we started. And we wrote loads and loads and loads. And then we launched. And, you know, for the first couple of years, I wouldn't say much happened. There weren't many views on it, but we kept putting out content. And then over the years, it's grown into something beyond the website. So there is still the website, but that's I'm not hugely involved with the website anymore. And, you know, that's not the biggest part of DFTB. Certainly for me, it's the community that we've built around it. So we run, we run online courses, we run conference, we have a community on Discord, and it's really about the community supporting each other and working together and kind of bringing the skills that everyone has got together at the right time and the right place to move quickly on projects that people are interested in. And, you know, we've been able to get a lot more done, impressive projects off the ground because of the community that DFTB is.
That's amazing. So how many people are in the team for DFTB? Because you have a YouTube channel as well, right? And a podcast. And there's obviously the Twitter, Instagram, website, mailing list. Like, it's a lot of work. How many people are in the team?
Do you know, the good thing about a community is that I don't think you can really say an exact number, because there's people at different levels of community. There's like, so there'll be some, I think there's like 400 people on the Discord server.
Wow.
But a lot of these people will just watch, you know, they won't necessarily take part, but they're also, I am that person in other communities, and I know that I still feel that I get value out of the community, and I actually still feel part of it, even if no one else in it knows who I am. So I actually think all of these people are play a role. So I couldn't, and then there's everyone who emails us, who comments on Twitter, comes to the event. So we actually have a hard trouble defining how many people there are in the team. There's probably, I would say, 40 people who are day-to-day creating stuff and, you know, heavily involved in creating content for DFTB.
Yeah, I think it's amazing. It's been so useful to me throughout my medical training and pediatric training. And I just love, even if I'm like scrolling Instagram, I can learn really useful information just from a small infographic that's come up from the DFTB page. So if anyone's listening and has any form of pediatrics in their career, I would really recommend following DFTB, because it's really, really helpful to have those bite-sized pieces of information. So you mentioned that when you started it, it didn't really gain much traction for a few years. What made you carry it on? What made you stay motivated to carry on doing it?
We loved it. We had a great team. The four of us had a blast working together, and we enjoyed creating stuff. I mean, maybe it's like you with the podcast, like, you know, you just, when you're doing something that you really enjoy, you feel like you're in your zone. And it doesn't, I'm not saying it doesn't matter whether anyone likes it or not, because it does, but you kind of, I don't know, you feel motivated to keep going. And the truth is that there's loads of stuff that we do that doesn't work now. It's not that everything we do now is massively successful. You just get used to being relentlessly persistent, and you know, eventually some things pay off and do well and others don't.
And do you have any particular things that come to mind if I were to ask about any challenges that you faced along the way of the creation of DFTB and where it is today?
So at the beginning, in the first few years, the biggest challenge was just creating content, because we knew that, you know, so many people start a blog, and then the reality of putting out posts every week, or actually at the beginning, we were doing 3 posts a week, I think, probably for the first 6 wow. years, 7 years. We were doing, 3 posts a week. It's a lot. It's fine when you're enthusiastic for the first few months, but to keep that going is really hard. And there were only 4 of us. So, you know, it is a lot of work. And so we started to think, like, how sustainable is it? How, you know, we're 4 years in, we're none of us getting any younger. Like, how realistically are we going to keep going? And so that's a challenge, thinking about how can you bring other people into the team. People started writing posts for us, so that was helpful. But how do you make people not just feel like they're writing a post for Don't Forget the Bubbles, but that they're actually, they are DFTB, and it's not just the 4 of us. And now I think when people think about DFTB, they don't actually think about the 4 original people. But for the first 5 years, it was like, that's what our names were associated with it. And we really tried hard to build a team that owned DFTB to help make it sustainable. And I think, you know, we have managed to achieve that, but that was a big turning point for us.
sustainability in projects is something that I've only recently started to consider. So like with the podcast, I could have said I will just do an episode every week for 2 years, but I know I won't keep up with that. And it's a lot of work. I need to find time to record and edit and create all the like teasers and things. So I actually told myself I'll do 10 episodes and then take a 6 week break or so and then start again. Whereas last year I tried to start a YouTube channel, but putting out 1 to 2 videos every week was really difficult for me and it wasn't sustainable. And then I ended up just giving up. So I think thinking about how you can make something have a long life within your ability can really help.
It's so true. And you know, we have the same issue with the YouTube video. Can you put out one a week? It is a lot of work to do a YouTube video a week. But the thing, I mean, for me, is not doing it on my own has been a major factor. So all of the things that I've done that have been the most fun and the most successful have been with other people, because you've got someone to bounce ideas off when something goes wrong. You've got someone to help you keep it in perspective. You've got someone to share your wins with who really is supportive. And yeah, so that these have been the best projects, is getting the best people working alongside me.
I can definitely appreciate that. Did you ever expect it to become this big and successful?
No. I think it's fair to say no. One of the best things that, one of the best things that happened, or a significant thing that happened, was that when it was the pandemic, we started collecting all the data that was coming out on children with COVID. And we were the first people to do that. There was no one else in the world collecting this data. And Ali Munro led the project. And he put together a DFTB team and we put it on a web page. And every single paper that came out on kids with COVID, the team went through, they kind of did a summary of, they tagged it, they added it to a database. And we were like the leading organization in the world that had this COVID pediatric data. And it was such a good project led by Ali, and that he also partnered with the RCPCH later, that it actually got referenced in 2 WHO documents on return to school. And which is just like that is an example that just like literally blows my mind, because when you talk about 4 people who don't know what they're doing starting a blog, it wouldn't even been in my realm of thinking of things that we might achieve for that to happen. So, you know, you can, if you get the right people, and it wasn't like I was slightly involved in that project, but not heavily. It was totally led by other people. But because we've created like a community of people who can get together, and we don't have like a million committees to get through to make stuff happen, we were able to react quickly. And so I do really believe that DFTB was the only organization who could make that happen at that time, in that place, in that way. And so it all just falls together at times if you get a good team and good community around you.
To think that you 10 years ago, putting out that tweet saying, does anyone want to start a pediatric blog with me, has then culminated into that sort of thing and being referenced in a WHO guideline, is just mind-blowing. And I guess you would have
it's ridiculous.
You would have never imagined it.
No.
Would you say that's been one of the highlights of DFTB?
Well, yes, there have been many. I would say probably not similar, or the opposite end of the spectrum, was when we did the Lego paper, which I don't know if you were familiar with, but it is okay. So a couple of years ago, 6 of us swallowed a Lego head to see how long it took to pass the Lego head. And we wrote it up as a study. So we had I had to like sift through my poo for fortunately only 2 days. And then I found it on my second or third poo, so it could have been a lot worse. And actually one of us, Damien Roland, he didn't manage to find his early on. And so we'd agreed that if that happened, you would keep searching through your poo for 2 weeks, which is what he diligently did. And he never located it.
So he probably still has a Lego head.
He could still be out there, but I suspect he's just not a very good looker. then we wrote it up, you know, and it was funny. We used the fart score, the found and retrieve time. We used the school hardness and transit time, which was the SHAT score. And we wrote it up and it got published in the Journal of Pediatrics and Child Health. And when it published, it went viral, because it's hilarious. It's about poo, it's got fart jokes, it's got some science, it's about Lego. And so it literally, like, in a week exploded through all news channels. I guess this happens all the time, but I've never experienced anything like it. And it culminated in us being on the on James Corden and Jimmy Fallon's opening monologues of their primetime US shows.
Oh my goodness.
Made a joke about the paper. And it was terrible science, and everyone, lots of very clever academics on Twitter were telling us how it was terrible science and they couldn't believe it was published. But it was fun and it was funny. And yeah, so the reach, not the WHO, but it was primetime US show, was a different type of highlight. But, you know, there's just so many like fun stuff that we get to do with DFTB.
That's great. I love that. So such different highlights of DFTB, but both amazing in themselves. So when I think of you, I just think of medical education. I've been following you for years and following you on Twitter specifically for a long time. And I just love the content that you put out. It's the threads that you put out with all the information of different advice on how to do slides, how to give a talk, how to give a presentation. Like, you are just the medical education person to me, and not just in a pediatric sense, but in a whole medical sense. And I just wondered how you got to doing that, and how the kind of Twitter presence you have now became, how it happened.
Well, I mean, I don't think I've got a clever answer to this. It came from starting a blog with these three other people, because we got to try different stuff, and you know, some of the stuff I've done has been terrible. And I've got better over the years. And, you know, we've been able to try so many different things. It's like, it's having a safe community where you can just have a stupid idea and go for it. Like swallowing Lego heads, which I can't remember. It was not my idea. I can't remember whose idea it was. But, you know, for someone to be able to have that idea and then everyone to go, yeah, let's do it. And then actually do it and actually sift through your poo and write. You know, that's like it's a unique community to be able to do that. So that gives you the chance to try YouTube, to try a podcast, to try an online course and do something bold with the online course. And if it fails, okay, you've tried it, but it's through trial and error that things have ended up getting better. But with a lot of the Twitter, I've been doing quite a lot of Twitter stuff in the last 6 to 9 months, and a lot of that of that education is about writing, being able to write well. And so I have worked hard on how to write well in short format and get the message across, because there is different skills with writing a paper for an academic journal, a blog post, doing this podcast for you, or, you know, all of the, and YouTube, they all have different skill sets. So I think, you know, I just try to, I try to get slightly obsessed with and just work hard and learn. You know, I basically look at the best people who I love who are doing it and try and work out what they're doing and learn from them.
So if you, because like for me, when I share something on my Instagram, a lot of the time it would just be quite off the cuff. Like, I'll wake up and have an idea and just write a long caption whilst I'm in bed. Like, I don't really often set time aside, or something will happen at work and I decide to share something that I learned in an anonymous way. How do you go about doing your Twitter threads? Or if there was someone, say a colleague of mine, who one day wanted to be like you, what kind of things do you do to then create those threads? Because they're so good, they're so useful, they have a lot of reach. And I just wondered what the behind the scenes of all of that is like.
So I do work hard. I have been working hard on Twitter. I mean, you can do it that way. And I know a lot of people on Twitter, they're not there to kind of put out content to other people or necessarily to grow their Twitter following. And that's fine. So I guess it depends what is for you. So for me, I do content creation. I want to put out content that my audience, whoever they may be, enjoys and shares, and then that my audience will grow and I'll get to share that content with more people. And so for that, you need to waking up and having an idea and posting something is fine. And I do that sometimes, but that's not going to get you like sustainable following or sustainable growth, if that's what you want to achieve, because you can't, I mean, you're unlikely to have a great, interesting post every day.
Yeah.
I mean, you may do, I wouldn't. And it's hard to start. And then it's also quite time consuming, because then every day you're having to spend however long it takes you to think about that, to write it and post it. And that takes you out of doing something else. So what I've tried to do is come up with a better system. So what sort of stuff that I post about, I know the types of content, and some of which you mentioned that I post about. And so I tend to try and sit down once a week and write whatever I'm going to write for the week and just schedule it so that I'm not on Twitter all the time, checking notifications, replying, posting. And that way I get to kind of streamline my time better and work on other stuff.
Yeah, because as you say, so with how I do it on my Instagram, there'll be the odd post. I think my aim is slightly different to yours, but yeah, I'll have the odd post that people really resonate with and share and really enjoy. But then I might have lots and lots of posts in between. But that's because I do it very differently to you and I'm quite off the cuff with it. But it's interesting to hear how you do it, and you set aside the time, you research, you obviously must plan the threads in detail, because even making a thread is difficult as it is, and having all the links and things in there.
But I think also Instagram, I don't really use Instagram, but it is different from, you know, not all social media platforms are the same. So Instagram is more you sharing what you're doing off the cuff, and that will go down better with your audience. So I think it's wherever you are and whatever you're posting is, think about what you're there for. Why are you there? And then make sure whatever you do is tailored to achieving why you're there, because otherwise you're just wasting your time. Yeah. So, you know, for you, that's meaningful on Instagram, and you get some people like some of your posts, and that's good. And so that works for you. I think Twitter is different. Like, the type of content that people want is different. So it just needs to be tailored and thought through for you and for whoever is reading it.
And how do you deal with the notifications? Because literally, if I have one tweet that gets a little bit of traction, I get overwhelmed with it. How do you deal with it? Because you must get so many notifications.
Well, you can mute. If you've got a tweet that's going very well, you can mute notifications for that tweet in the Twitter app. So you don't have to. You also don't have to keep checking Twitter all the time. So there's other apps and software that you can use for Twitter. And I would guess they'll be the same for Instagram, where you can just see, you can log on and see engagements or comments or whatever you want to do. You know, it depends how involved you want to get. If you want to get very involved in Twitter and optimizing your Twitter, then you can go down a rabbit hole of different software, different courses. It's the same with any niche, you know, when you get into it and you want to like become master that, then, you know, there's a whole wealth of information out there to learn and improve.
So what drives you every day to do this stuff? Why do you love it?
What drives me is the community, is feeling connected to my team and other people who I meet who enjoy and learn from what we've created, and even other people who feel like that inspires them to then go and do something else. So it's definitely, it's the people that I work with each day. They are fun. Like, I like working with them, and that makes me get up and keep going.
And how do you blend your clinical work with your education side of your career? Do you blend them a lot?
Well, I get days that are, I mean, when I'm on a, you know, I'm on a shift, I'm doing clinical shift, and you do your normal education within the shift. So we try to do teaching. We have a board round where and you know, there's lots of educational things there. But I have days of the week that are allocated to my university stuff, and I have time that I allocate to, don't forget the bubble stuff. So I try and be, and also I do have a family with three children and two dogs, so you know, I do need to spend time with them as well. So although we're talking about the kind of professional split, you know, all of these are streamlined, are ring-fenced time around making sure that I get to spend time with my family.
That was actually something I wanted to ask you about, because when I first approached you for the podcast, I remember you saying to me, please, is it possible for us to do working hours, because I try to block off my evenings and weekends for my family. I really appreciated that you said that, because it kind of gave me a perspective of how I might want to structure my time when I'm a consultant, or even now as well. What other things do you do to balance that family and work split and having three children and two dogs?
Look, I am not the perfect parent. I am doing my best, and varying degrees of success at different times. And it's not easy, because, you know, we all work hard, and I do extracurricular stuff. That means that I do work. It's, you know, I'm not like when I said, you know, I would prefer to keep stuff that could happen during the day to happen during the day. But it would be disingenuous to say I don't do any work in the evenings, because that's not true. But you know, I think there, especially now, my kids are basically secondary school age. The last one's just finishing primary school. And they do need you a bit differently and more in the evenings than when they're younger. And then, you know, when they're younger, they go to bed at 6:30 and you have the whole evening to yourself. That is not the case now. So I know it's important to try and parent well and use the opportunity to connect with them while I can. And work is such an easy distraction, because I really enjoy my work, and I enjoy looking at my notifications or whatever, you know, so checking my email. So I just try to be a bit disciplined about that and make sure that there's, I know there's certain times in the evening where the kids are around or giving, you know, we only have a window where they actually want to talk to us. And I make sure I'm available for that. And, you know, weekends are very important to us as well. And so, yeah, it's just, it's hard. It's not, you know, I'm not perfect, and I'm just trying to be better, basically.
As a pediatric trainee, seeing you work more than full time and have three children and still manage to balance it is really nice for me, because it's something I really worry about. And I know a lot of other female junior doctors and medical students worry about as well, about balancing their career that we've worked so hard towards and spent such a long time like passing exams and doing courses and things, and then having children and balancing that. So yeah, seeing what you do is quite inspiring for people my age and in my level where we haven't had children yet, but it will be something hopefully in the future, and seeing how you balance that. Did you find it really hard at any point, or is it still hard at any point, balancing having children and your career?
It is hard. I worked part-time for some of my training. And you know, I'm lucky to have some flexibility around my having a university role as well as my clinical role. It's hard, you know, but everyone's got a lot on, you know, there's no, got to work to earn a living to keep my kids in the style they're accustomed to. You know, I don't have, yeah, that's just the way it is. You just need to find what works for you. And at the moment, this balance is working well for us. But you know, it may change. It wasn't the same in the past, and I did do different work patterns, and I'm sure it will change in the future. And just need to, what I try to do is keep options open for, you know, I have lots of areas of interest, and so I have the opportunity to do the university job, do the clinical work, so that I'm not, you know, I'm not reliant on one particular thing, and it just gives me flexibility for where my career might go in the future.
Where do you think your career might go in the future?
I don't know. I wish I did know. I actually, at the college conference, there was a workshop on lifelong careers. So they've started this thread, this kind of theme in the college, where they've got Dal Hottie, who is a nephrologist at Gosh, I think, is taking on a college role for lifelong careers, which I think is brilliant, because I don't think we really, I know as trainees, you always talk about like where you're going. So you know what you're doing, right? You've got to do your ARCP, you've got to do this, and you know, you've got to go through the years, and then you're a consultant and you're so happy because you finally got a job and you never thought it would happen. You've got a permanent job, but then you're there for that. You've still got 25 years of your career or however long left. So what happens then? And actually there's no one really talks to you about that. There isn't anything. So I think that the fact that the college have this lifelong careers idea is brilliant. But yeah, so I went, there was a workshop on it at the conference, and one of the things was thinking about where you want to be in 5 years, and I realized that I have no idea. So that is the answer. I don't know.
So what exactly do they mean by lifelong careers? Is it essentially what you're doing after you're a consultant?
Yeah, I suppose it's what I take from it is that it's thinking, so you get your consultant job, I'm 4 years into mine. And then at some point, maybe 7-8 years, you start thinking, well, what's going to happen? Like, is that what you're doing for the next 20 years? And for some people, that's fine. For some people, it's not going to be, what they want to be doing when they're 60. So how do we plan, rather than waiting until you're 55 and you're resentful of everyone? How do you plan to make sure you've got a fulfilling career beyond you've made it to the end of training and got your consultant job? And yeah, I mean, thankfully there's someone else with this role at the college, because I don't know the answers, but hopefully they will support me and other members and you as well when you get there to be able to think about that and plan that more. I think it will be a great resource.
That really is great, because you're right. All I think about is almost like the jump. I don't like to think of it as tick boxes, but they almost do become tick boxes of becoming a consultant. And I'm aware that I want to take years out, and I want to lengthen my time until I am a consultant. But then you do kind of just think of that as the final hoop to jump through, and then you're there and you've made it and your career is done. But actually that's the beginning of a very long career as a consultant in whatever specialty you do. So that's nice that there's support out there to kind of think about how you want those years of your consultant life to be.
Exactly. And by the time you get there, there'll be an amazing program available. So it won't be, you'll have so many resources. But at the moment, it's just kicking off. But I think I'm excited to see what they do with it.
And can I ask, you said you've been a consultant for 4 years. How did you find the transition? Because I know I'm not even a registrar yet, but I am very scared for that transition to becoming consultant.
So, you will feel differently by the time you get to the end, because, if you take years, I had three kids, I moved from the UK to Australia, and so I did my training in Australia and then moved back. And honestly, by then I'd done so many years of being a registrar. You get to a point where you know how to be a registrar and you feel comfortable doing that. So it's not like it's not stressful going to the next stage, but you do feel like, okay, it's time to move on. So, and people may find, I'd be interested to hear people who just go straight through their run through training and then get a job at the end. I don't know if they feel differently, but I took a much longer route and I felt ready when I was there. I was the fellow at the Royal London PEDS Emergency before I was a consultant. So I started in a department that already knew me and I loved them and it was a great place to work. So I think that probably eased the transition for me a bit.
Fair enough. And is it how you expected being a consultant?
Yeah, it is how I expected. I really, the reason I wanted to work at the Royal London is because I love the team there. I love that that they're not all the same. We're not all the same. And, I didn't want to work somewhere where everyone is just the same as me with the same, the same type of person, the same interest. And I love that we're all so different, because that's what makes a good team is different people having different opinions, but different skills and different experience. It's just a great team. And it's a fun and exciting place to work. So it is what I expected. And yeah, I've enjoyed it so far.
That makes me feel more reassured. I wanted to move on to, you mentioned at the beginning the work you had done with stabbing victims. I just wondered if you could talk more about that, or have I understood it wrong?
No, I mean, I was only slightly involved with the project. It's a project that was started by Anna Waddington, who is a good friend of mine, who's a nurse at the Royal London. And they basically run, they go into detention centres, prisons, and try to reach young people who are at risk of serious youth violence and teach them some skills. So it's basic hemorrhage control skills, basic first aid, but it's more than just teaching them the skills. It's about meeting them, talking to them, and kind of breaking down the barriers between healthcare professionals and them. And we see lots of young people who have been stabbed or are involved in gangs at our hospital, and often they end up coming back. We have a really good program of violence reduction, of which I'm not involved with at all, who all help to work with these young people. And Anna Waddington has been part of that, and she started Your Stance, and I joined her along with Helen Ormrod, who's one of the other nurses, to try and help get it going and get it off the ground. I'm not actually involved with it anymore, but it's a huge success because of Anna, and they have achieved just amazing things. And again, I think it's just another example of getting teams together with the right people, because we all have very different skill sets. I'm not the person that goes out and teaches the young people and, does the training, but I've been able to help with other things around developing the team and growing the idea and the strategy. And so, yeah, I think it's just getting the right people together in the right place.
What would you say? You said it's been really successful. What defines the success?
Well, I think, you probably need to ask Anna. but I would say the number of young people that she's reached and hearing them say what they've done with the training that they've given, so that they maybe would then use it or be more aware of what to do if something happens in future, or even feel more confident, unrelated to that situation, but just more confident in themselves. So I think, and also a lot of healthcare professionals have got involved because it's volunteers who go and run the sessions. So yeah, that's probably a plug that if anyone is listening who wants to volunteer, then I know Anna would love for more volunteers. And it's given an opportunity for a lot of our staff to be able to go and do that and really kind of go out into the community of people that we see and talk to them in a different situation, you know, at a different kind of level.
Yeah, instead of talking to them when they've come in an acute situation, actually having that time and environment to speak to these people and educate them. So I'll leave a link to that in the show notes. Tell me a bit more about the work you do with the university and your, is it the master's that you've now developed?
Yes, so I'm. I was the PEDS lead on an existing master's, which is emergency medicine, emergency and resuscitation medicine, and I basically set up a new pediatric emergency medicine master's, which is online. So it's a distance learning part-time course, and it took about, I would say, 18 months to get the course approved and through the university, and then we launched last September. So we've run the first year. We're about to start the second year.
Wow.
And it's just been amazing. I've got like a great faculty who we just love working together, and it's been exciting because it's like starting something, a whole new thing from like zero to actually having students go through the course. And yeah, it's going to be when they finish the first year, when they get to the end of the third year and we get some students getting their masters, I think we're all going to be crying at their graduation, because it will be really wonderful. And it's connecting people who all live in different parts of the world in different disciplines. So they're not all doctors, there's nurses, paramedics, and they all learn together. We all learn together online and try and kind of share our learning, learn how to go away and look up resources, how to look at papers and understand them, and then present that back to everyone so that it makes sense for our practice. So it's another version of trying to build a community that is a learning community, but in a more formal setting through the university.
That's a huge achievement. How did you even go about starting that and setting it up? Was it your idea and then it became a thing?
It's just one stage at a time, I think. So Tim Harris, who's the program director of the emergency one that I'm PEDS lead on, said, you should set up a PEDS emergency masters. I've not set up a university course before, but I have designed a lot of educational programs. So it was just going through the university process, which is slow and bureaucratic and, you know, challenging, but in the end managed to get a course approved that looks great, that is educationally great, that meets all the university requirements, and then we were able to launch it. So it was cool.
And how did you go about making 3 years worth of content?
So the thing about this course is that there is no lectures. So it is it's heavily around forum discussion. We use a platform called Circle, and we have tutorials, but the aim is that we are teaching people how to find out the information, to present it, digest it, and share it. And so it's asynchronous, so people can come and go, everyone's got shifts and so on, and together we create the content together along with some tutorials. So it's an ongoing work in progress, and then the next year we'll do the same thing, and over time there will be a body of educational material created. But it's about the community and learning experience. For me, with a lot of education, I don't feel there's a huge benefit to watching someone deliver a lecture, a recorded lecture that's for 60 minutes long. I think it's, you know, people can go away and watch that in their own time. So the question is, what can you gain from any course you go to, any teaching you go to as a learner? What's the benefit to you to being there at that time? And that's what you need to do as a teacher, as an educator, is think, well, how are you making it valuable for these students? And so that they can contribute and they can learn, rather than just recording whatever it is you want to say and making them watch it. So that's why we've not done lectures, which I think was the first course that QMUL has that doesn't have lectures. So it maybe was a bit of a tough sell at the beginning, but hopefully, I think I was able to show that it was about the community, about learning through a community of practice.
It sounds like you're kind of teaching people how to do what you do, like find their information themselves, process it, and make it shareable and learnable. It almost like problem-based learning at med school.
It is, but that's what life is, isn't it? Because you're not going to, when your next patient comes in, you're not going to automatically remember the lecture you watched about croup or whatever it is, you know, you will go away, you'll look, they'll say, well, what dose of Dex am I going to use? Should I give 0.6 or 0.15? And you think, well, should I? I don't know. And then fine, you can go and look at the guideline and do what it says. But actually, you could actually think, well, why? How? Why am I choosing one dose over the other? Or there's a new paper come out. Do I know what it means for me? That is what we do every day. That's what all of us do. So I think a better skill is knowing how to handle that within your team when new things come up, rather than being a bank of, you know, vast knowledge, of which I am not. And, you know, most people don't hold all that knowledge in their head.
Mm. And do you think that it being like a post-COVID era, kind of, do you think that's made a huge difference to how you've been able to deliver the masters, or do you think it would have always been virtual?
So the masters was before COVID. It was going through before COVID. I was lucky with the timing, because then the universities were all keen to do online learning at that time. But it launched in September 2021, but it took 2 years to go through. So it started going through before the pandemic even existed. So it was always going to be an online course. So I don't think it's been strengthened by the pandemic, but it was fortuitous timing, I think it's fair to say.
Yeah, and I reckon people are more open to online learning now since COVID. So that might...
Yeah, I mean, the adult emergency medicine master's that I'm on has been going for years longer than mine, and is online learning as well. So it's not the... I think there's always been online courses that have been very successful, and the emergency one's very successful. But definitely people are more open to doing courses online now than they were before.
And have you seen that in the uptake from the adult emergency medicine one, or has it always been similar?
Well, I mean, their course is much more established. Okay. So they are, you know, it's an excellent course. We're just starting out, so we're trying new things to see how it works and learning how our students enjoy it and what they think about it. So yeah, it's the same with everything. It takes time to refine and get it good. But we've been lucky to have a really good cohort of students for the first lot who are very enthusiastic and really engaged with the course.
I really like how much you've kind of talked about the community in education, and it's not really something I've thought about that much before, but hearing how much you've talked about it and how much it like nourishes that learning environment, it enables you to have people to talk to, and like creating that team really does make a difference. Is there anywhere else in your career or life that you've have applied this?
Well, I think I can't think of many things that, you know, aren't better by learning them with someone else. Like everything that you, all your hobbies or things that you do, or certainly the ones that I do, I enjoy them more because of the people that are there with me. I'm not saying I don't do it, you know, I read a book on my own. It's not that.
Group reading, you know, session.
I'm guessing that's the thing. These are the things that I'm drawn to. So all of the things that I do are geared towards the people who are doing them with me and the people who are receiving whatever the output is and how it impacts them. And I do think that for everyone creating content, you're creating it for the recipients, not for yourself. And it's the same, like I know you mentioned about the presentation. That's the same with presentations, you know. You're not presenting for yourself. I know you've been asked to speak on a topic that you love, so you've got things you want to say, but it's for the people who are receiving it. So it's thinking about what they want, what are they coming to hear? The same with education. How are they going to get the most out of it? And if you start looking on it that way, you're going to produce a much better quality of content.
Yeah, even like with the podcast, some people have always said, think about who's going to be listening to it rather than me, as in, to be honest, the people listening are probably people similar to me, so that helps as well. But with any kind of content that you're putting out, thinking about who's receiving it and who's consuming it, in inverted commas, really does help how you angle the whatever it is, Instagram, Twitter, teaching to medical students, whatever, putting it in their shoes does really help. You mentioned your hobbies then. So what are your hobbies? What do you do in your spare time?
No, I don't. That is all my spare time. I think we're all between that and the family. My spare time would be doing something, an activity with my kids as an extra. I don't have any wild separate hobbies. I will be doing jigsaws with my kids or playing board games with them.
Oh, that's really nice though. I love a jigsaw. I have a 2,000 piece jigsaw puzzle in my cupboard that I've had for like years, and I'm like, I just need time to do it, and I haven't done it yet.
Well, we've got a big table. We're only up to 1,000, and that basically is our maximum space. So a big table or small pieces.
Yeah. So one question I always like to ask everyone that comes on the podcast is, what piece of advice would you give to a younger version of yourself if you could go back and tell young Tessa a piece of advice from the future? What would it be?
It would be to just enjoy the people that you're with, enjoy your team, your colleagues, and that when you find good people that you feel that you work well with, to hang on to them and keep doing more of what you're doing, basically, because the time where you feel happiest professionally in whatever sphere that is, you want to do more of that. You want to find a way to do more of that. And if you just keep trying, opportunities do come up eventually. Even if you don't see the payback initially, it does all help in the long run.
And on that note, you've had a very successful career and you're only at the beginning of your consultant career. Have there been times where you've felt that things weren't going to plan, or you felt like giving up, or very big challenges that you wouldn't mind sharing with us?
I think, you know, exam failure is probably like an early one that lots of people go through. Is, you know, we're very used to being successful people at, you know, everything. We've gone to medical school, we've all been, you know, we're all being told that we're very clever, and then you realize that actually you didn't pass your exams, and you know, that's pretty, it's horrible. It is horrible. And it does make you question professionally yourself. So I think that, you know, failing exams, my PEDS exams, was a challenge, but I know a lot of people are in the same boat. So again, I think that's probably like persistence. For me, the biggest challenges are the balance of the professional and the personal. Mm. And just, you know, I'm trying to, certainly in the last couple of years, as my kids have got a bit older, really trying to prioritize being able to be present for them and for my husband, and to make sure that work is work and home is home. And that's not easy. So that's probably the biggest hurdle.
Yeah. I saw your tweet from, I think, a few days ago, where you talked about medical exams are very different to actually being a good doctor. And it's so true. Being asked some SBAs on which one is the most likely, and being able to pick up the buzzwords and connect it to an answer, is so different to being on a ward or in an A&E or in a GP surgery. And I think we put so much pressure on exams at medical school, even before we start A-levels, GCSEs, all of it, throughout our careers, it's all about exams. But I think I've definitely learned that there is such a difference between the two, and how you apply yourself, and who, being good at exams doesn't necessarily mean you're an excellent doctor, and vice versa.
No, they're different skills. I understand why you have to do exams. You know, you have to know stuff. Like, that's fine. You have to have been shown that you know stuff. You have to be able to demonstrate that you know stuff. But in reality, that's not what day-to-day medicine is, and it's not what a career in medicine is. It's about your interpersonal skills, your teamwork, how to deal with difficult situations and difficult colleagues, difficult, you know, challenging families, challenging clinical scenarios, making mistakes, learning, getting better, all of these things. That's what actual medicine is about. And that's what being a good doctor is being able to learn these skills. And I certainly didn't get taught any of them in medical school. I don't know if they're teaching them any better now, but it's a hard thing to teach. It is a hard thing to teach.
I'm sure that some of the listeners will have also failed exams and be struggling with processing that. But I hope that this is just some reassurance that doctors fail exams and we're still where we are today. And it doesn't mean you'll be a bad doctor. It's a challenge that you need to overcome, but it doesn't mean you'll be a bad doctor by any stretch of the imagination.
No, I don't think it's got anything to do with being a bad doctor at all. It's literally that you have not been able to pass this exam at that time. That's it.
Yeah, I agree. Well, Tessa, thank you so much for talking to me today. It's been so nice to get to know a bit more about what you do, to learn about why you do what you do, and just have a chat with you, especially because I've been following you for so long. I honestly did feel a bit starstruck at the beginning. So thank you for being such a lovely guest and sharing so much with us.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been fun talking to you.
Thank you. Thanks so much for listening. If you've enjoyed the show so far, then don't forget to subscribe and please leave a review on your podcast app, as it really helps other people find out about it. If you have any feedback or suggestions, drop me a line on my Instagram @DrRadica. The link is in the show notes. Have a good week.